Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome. I'm Dr. Deborah.
Hi, it's Therapist Kelly.
How are you, sweet Kelly?
My little chicken's with us today.
I know.
My older one is here. He kind of said, I'm not going to camp, sort of stampede, and here he is.
Here he is, happily on his iPad.
Exactly. It's so funny because I could say anything and he doesn't hear me right now. He's got his headphones and he's in his own world.
Own world. That's awesome.
How are things?
Good. Oh my God. We went to Pismo Beach over the weekend. It was so delightful.
I love Pismo.
It's like 72 degrees. We stayed a little bit outside of the center part.
But okay.
There was like a 15-minute walk to get into where the pier is and the restaurants and the shops and all that. So we weren't like in the crowd, but it was just so wonderful. You know, they have some pretty cool outlet stores at Pismo.
Yes. Well, yeah. And David and I did those like dune buggies.
Yes, I've done that twice before. We opted out for this time. I just didn't want to hurt my back, but I did run on the beach.
Oh my God.
My first run in a long time.
Wow.
It felt fantastic yesterday. Not so
good today. It's a lot of pressure on your body. I used to be a runner, and my knees got really messed up.
Your knees, my back. Yeah.
Well, although I signed up for a mud run.
You did?
Yes. And I'm like petrified. Like I signed up all gung ho, and then I'm like, what the hell am I doing? I have like no endurance.
You literally run through mud, right?
Yes. And you do like obstacles, like climbing over things and swimming through things. I mean,
what compelled you to do this stupid thing?
Yes, exactly. My friend asked me and I'm like, yeah, I'll show her. And then I was like, what the hell am I doing? Because like you need endurance.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, this is not like for the, you know, weak like me.
How many miles?
It's a 5K. Ooh. I know. So I'll see what
3.2
happens.
3.2 miles.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Oh,
yes.
My goodness. My goodness. That's.
Sorry.
That is. Remy's playing a game probably, right?
Yes,
and
exactly.
He just beat the computer.
Yeah, exactly. And he's like screaming in delight.
Such a smart boy.
As he like moans in weird language.
So yeah, I mean, I can't think of too much else. I mean, let's see, what do we got going on? It's summertime now, so that's always fun.
Yeah,
I thought there was going to be less traffic getting here. There was more than ever, but that's okay. We made it.
Yeah,
a little frazzled.
I'm going to go camping, I think, in a couple months.
Where?
I had Remy sign up for Boy Scouts. So, like, this is legitimate camping. This is not, like, glamping. like, this is, like, the serious stuff. So, that'll be interesting.
I did that with Tiffany when she was 8 years old. We went to this campground through the Girl Scouts.
Oh.
Poor little girl. She got a migraine. She wanted to play with all of her buds so much. And she got this terrible migraine. So, she and I were just in the tent all by ourselves. And I was just trying to rub her head and all that.
Oh, it's
kind of
painful.
Stuff. Oh, it's so painful. She doesn't get them anymore, I don't think. Hardly ever. But, she had a lot of those then. But that's fun.
Yeah.
It's really fun. You do lots of things with lots of groups.
Oh, I'm excited.
It's not usually all that pretty, though, just so you know. They usually pick these campsites that are very big.
That's
with
so
a
funny.
Lot of, I mean, maybe that's what it was then.
Yeah.
So where's that?
It's at Camp Whitsitt.
I don't know where that
family
is.
Family camp or something? Yeah.
Yeah, family camp. It's going to probably be really crowded and dusty.
Things to look forward to.
I was going to say, you're going camping without me. That's not fair.
No, I was going to say, no, you're my camping woman.
Yes.
I mean, who else would cook for me? Come on.
Exactly. Scallops.
Exactly. I cannot believe, they were like one of the best tasting scallops ever, too. And there you are, like, sweating over this poor thing. I felt so bad.
That's what was the ingredient, was my sweat. That's what made them so good.
Oh.
You didn't know that?
Oh, geez.
That's hysterical. Oh, my God. Last week, she was just delightful.
I love her.
Oh, my
love
gosh.
Her.
Lulu Cerrone, Philanthro Parties author, a party planning guide for kids who want to give back. I kept thumbing through that book and just going, she's just so creative.
She was such a good soul. Like, I felt like she was like an old soul. And she was just genuine and authentic. And I, you know, she really just wants to give in the world. It's lovely.
It's
and
so,
so bright, too, and articulate.
Did you share some of her ideas with Remy? Because you thought Remy might be interested.
You know what?
I totally forgot,
but I will. I need that other reminder. It's like funny. It's like, you know, things come in my head and then the next second it's out. So I'll have to, because I think he will be into that, especially the animal stuff.
All righty. So drum roll for our guest today. Do you want to do it, the honors?
Sure. So today, I'm so excited. We have Faith Sally. She is the author of Approval Junkie. So Faith Sally is an Emmy-winning contributor to CBS Sunday Morning and a regular on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. She also hosts Science Goes to the Movies on PBS. Her book of essays, Approval Junkie, My Heartfelt and Occasionally Inappropriate Quest to Please Just About Everybody, and Ultimately Myself, has been called a magic mix of vulnerability and jest. For her newest podcast, Authorized, from Audible, Faith interviews writers about sex and love in literature and learns the difference between romance and erotica and also how to write bad sex scenes. Faith lives in NYC with her husband, two kids, and her husband's dog.
Hello, welcome.
Hi, I'm so happy to talk to you both. You're very impressive with the camping and the mud running.
I talk a good game. You'll see me out there. I don't know if you'll feel the same.
Oh my gosh.
Somebody's gonna take
I'm just pictures. Listening to your what you guys do for leisure, and I'm like, oh my God. This is why I live in the city, so I don't have to do that.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, you're right. That is funny. Yeah, because I lived in NYC for a while. It's like the outing to Central Park is like good enough, you know?
So I have a question.
I know. We always tell our kids when they're like, why can't we have a backyard? I'm like, you have Central Park on one side and the river on the other. You're set.
That is so cute. Faith, I love the cover of the book, Approval Junkie. The little girl on the cover. Was that you by chance?
That is me. Oh, thank you. So I sweet. Love this cover, too. They made a different, Crown made a different cover for the paperback because the hardcover looks totally different. Oh. And I have to say that yellow is a color I can never wear, but the paperback cover is yellow, and I look very fetching as a 4-year-old in this yellow paperback.
Adorable. Absolutely adorable.
Thank you.
And you look like you're up to potentially no good in that picture.
You
like,
really do. It's that face. It's that face.
You know what it is? And I know this is somewhat lost because we're on the radio, but it's the knee-high socks, right? Like,
oh, yes.
Any girl wearing like over-the-knee pink socks has to be a little mischievous.
Of course. And you have that look on your face like,
I ate the canary.
Mom does not know what I just did.
Yes. So cute.
Although the reality was quite different because I was an approval junkie my whole life. As a young girl, I don't think I really did that much wrong. So,
so it was just that face. So cute.
That is so funny because I would say for myself, I have always been an approval junkie, but I have been a rebel in disguise. I mean, I did so much stuff I wasn't supposed to do because I wasn't getting caught and I could get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I always wanted, so it depended.
That's interesting.
What I was doing depended on who I was trying to get the approval from.
Oh, so like friends or something.
Right.
In that
right.
way. Yeah.
So it was like, how do you navigate all of these plates?
Sure.
But
sure.
Oh, definitely can relate to this topic.
So, I think your kids are older. Well, I'm sure your kids are older than mine. My kids are 3 and 5. What happens when your kids come to you when they're older and say, Mom, did you ever do this or that? Do you tell them the truth? Yeah, I did that and I got away with it. What do you say?
Well, my daughter is 24 and Kelly's children are
goodness.
Okay. 8 and 4 and 8.
A half.
Yeah.
No, 7.
You're going to be 8 in like a month.
He's still claiming. He's claiming the stake in the 7. He said today he didn't want to be 8. He really likes 7.
Oh.
And it's an odd number.
Oh.
But anyway, he's going to be 8 and my other one's 4 and a half.
I have disclosed a number of things to my daughter and I shared my lessons with her. So the things that I learned, for one thing, my daughter did not grow up in the kind of restrictive or chaotic family life that I did. So, you know, she had a lot of permissibility to do a lot of things, even to the point where I said, if you're going to ditch, just call me and let me know so that you don't get in trouble with the school, too.
Right.
You know, so it was a lot of stuff. And in truth, then she felt such freedom to do what she wanted. She hardly did anything.
Makes sense. Yeah.
You know, whereas I did a lot.
Yeah, she
of
didn't
stuff.
Have anything to rebel
no.
against. Right.
Right. Yeah.
So, okay, we have so many questions for you. I absolutely love this topic. And when I would tell people that we were having you on the show and we were talking about approval, it's so funny how many people are like, oh, yeah, I always seek approval. Like, it's like no one's immune to it.
You know, I'm glad you say that because one of the reasons I wanted to write this book, and as you know, because not only, I'm sure, do you enjoy the cover, I'm sure you've probably flipped through it, it's not... You know, I'm not you guys. I'm not a trained psychological expert by any means. And so this book is not, you know, it's not prescriptive. It's not a self-help book. It's essays about experiences I've had in my life that I hope have either implicit lessons or just some kind of takeaway or resonance for people who read it. And when I first started thinking about, you know, writing or collecting my own stories around the topic of approval, it was interesting how much I found in the culture that was a message of, oh, I don't know if I can curse. Your child is close by.
No,
but I don't
listening.
Give an F. You know what I mean? I don't give an F. And I think there's this idea, and believe me, I am as feminist as they come, starting with my kids' hyphenated last names, mine first. but you know, I think there's also an idea of like young women, especially in our society, feminists, who think that part of being fierce and feminist is championing this idea that you shouldn't ever care what anybody else thinks. Mm. And I frankly don't think that serves anybody. Mm-hmm. Because I mean, it's part of the journey in my book. It's figuring out whose guidance and whose approbation matters. And ultimately, of course, we all know it is our own. We have to be right with ourselves and what we all want to approve of. But there are people, if you're a lucky person, if you're a discriminating person, you will surround yourself with some people in your life whose guidance and validation matters, mm-hmm. right? You want to marry or partner with someone whom you admire and trust. You want to work with or for people whom you admire. And I don't know. I just, sorry, go ahead.
No. The only thing I was going to say is that what you're speaking to the human language, I mean, yes. All of us are innately born with some need for the A's, I call them, acknowledgement, approval, admiration, affection, attention, mm-hmm. and that people who don't care at all about what other people think, they're usually sociopaths.
I was thinking that.
They're usually, those are the ones who should care about something. And the us guilt-bound people who are always worried about everybody else, we're the junkies.
Yes, it's
so there's got to be a healthy balance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, okay, so how did you come up with the idea of this? Like, was it just like, oh, I've been thinking about this, or...
You know, I had a boyfriend. Some parts of my book are about my with my first husband. I call him my husband. I'm now married to an amazing man, the mensch of all time, who seemingly always gives me his approval. I mean, approval isn't even on the table with my current husband because he just loves me unconditionally, which is mind-boggling. Aww. But I had a boyfriend while I was going through my divorce. And early on in our fairly short-lived relationship, he told me he was an intimacy junkie. And I thought, it just sort of made me think, gosh, and I've never done any drugs. Like, I've never smoked pot. I smoked a cigarette twice in my life, once when I was playing Sally Bowles in Cabaret, and once when I was playing Sandy in Grease, you know, the tell me about it that moment. So I'm not a junkie of anything. And I thought, if I am addicted to anything, what is it? And I sort of, you know, glibly said, oh, I guess I'm an approval junkie. Mm. And I just sort of tucked that away and never thought it was anything pernicious. And then when it came time to write my book, I had reached this really happy ending in my life where, you know, I was happily married. I became a mother for the first time in my 40s, and my career had turned into something I was really grateful for. I knew I wanted to write these stories, and I started looking at them and wondering if there was a thread that ran through them. And I realized so much of the stories I had to tell were about seeking approval, either from other people or from myself. And so I Googled approval junkie. And everything that came up on Google was like, how not to be an approval junkie, how to make sure you're not a people pleaser. It was like, I mean, this is sort of your purview. It was sort of psychological cautionary tales. And I just kind of thought, approval's not so bad. Like, my seeking approval kind of got me to where I am, and maybe it needs a little bit of an advocate.
I love it.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. It's a really good way to look at things. I really like that.
Gosh. Thanks. I mean, as you know, as you well know, you can go overboard. I mean, my first marriage was not at all healthy because I was trying to seek the love of someone who would never really, really give it to me. Mm. And, you know, I write about struggles with my body image, you know, this kind of validation of weighing 95 pounds for as long as I could, you know, that's not healthy either. Or, you know, my former career as an actor, where I was always waiting for someone to choose me. And that was just a combination of terrible ways of seeking approval. But, you know, when you guys are parents and you look back and, you know, there's really no harm in raising a kid who wants to make straight A's, who wants to work hard, who says thank you, who, you know, learns people's names. And I just kind of think that, and I'm sure you hear this all the time from your patients and clients, like the stories that we have about the things that we do to feel understood and recognized and loved, sometimes they're our most meaningful stories. Mm. They may be our most embarrassing stories, but they're really meaningful stories, what we have done in the name of being seen.
It's so true.
So true.
It's so true.
It is reminding me of my own funny story. I think I told you about how I learned to water ski.
No.
I was like 12 years old. Uh-huh. I don't remember how I ended up going to, I think it was Lake Arrowhead, but okay. I was with a couple of friends, but I don't know how that happened, like if we went with somebody's family or something. Yeah. And they did lessons for how to, you know, water ski.
Uh-huh.
Well, the instructor, of course, was adorable. He was probably like 22. I was 12. You know, no chance there, right? My bathing suit bottoms start to fall off.
It's the worst.
I was mortified because I wanted this guy to think I was the coolest skier on the planet. Right.
Well, you thought you were something else, that's for sure.
And about a little bit into it, where they were literally coming off, I'm like, yeah. I don't know what to do, but my bottoms are falling off. And I can't remember if I had him pull them up or because I couldn't let go. I was so afraid to fall anyway.
Yeah.
I don't know why that reminded me of that. You said the most embarrassing moments.
Well, it's so funny you said that because I'm thinking
of course,
about...
it's like Sophie's choice. Like, do I remain cool and stay up on the skis or do I show him my butt or
right.
what?
Cool and naked. Yes, of course. Perfect.
God. Well, it's so funny because they need to make those freaking bathing suits stronger, because I remember I have scary tales of me too, where my top just goes down in front of boys in like seventh grade. And of course, me being me says the next peep show is 12 o'clock because I'm like, what else can you do in this moment?
Gotta go with
you
it.
Know? Yeah. So
yeah, you owned it. I'm sure you got a lot of approval for your bathing right. suit top coming down.
Not at that age, sadly, but maybe now more.
Yeah, so you're right. I mean, a lot of our really touching moments in life is that we were trying to seek the approval of somebody in our lives who mattered to us.
Sure.
I think I get into trouble, though, when I care about people who I don't care about.
Oh,
you care about what people think about me who I don't care about them. Or I don't even respect them.
I think about that all the time. It makes no sense. I don't know if it's just a bruise to our ego, or what do you think, Faith?
I mean... yes, it does make no sense. And I just think it's like part of the human condition. And especially in this age of social media, mm-hmm. it is almost inescapable. I mean, you have to choose to put blinders on or escape it if you don't want to know what people think of you.
Right.
And you know, one of the things I do on CBS Sunday Morning, I do amazing stories on other people, which is such a privilege. But I also do commentaries where I talk for 2 minutes about some opinion I have. And, you know, sometimes I like to think that they're trenchant and meaningful, but sometimes, you know, sometimes I'm talking about how we should use the word whom and, you know, how we should have good grammar. Like stuff where it's like, come on, everybody, it's Sunday morning. Let's all have a little sense of humor. Like, this is not entirely serious. And yet, inevitably, if I choose to look on the Facebook page of Sunday Morning or look at my tweets or, you know, check my general public email, there will be people who I not only don't like, but have never met, never will meet, who say hateful things to me, like mm-hmm. personal hateful things. And I would just say another shade of that is there's like, I do believe there's real misogyny. I mean, when I am attacked for being on TV, some people want to talk about the way I sound or the way I look in a way that I don't think people, if someone disagreed with a man, mm-hmm. they would ever... Right. Throw in how he sounds or looks,
it's
don't
true.
You think?
Yes.
Absolutely.
100%.
100% agree.
Yeah. So sorry, I'm digressing. I just get up on my feminist platform.
Go ahead, I want to tell you something,
but,
too.
But, you know, it is a real sort of challenge of what I do, and you guys are also, you know, somewhat in the public in your professional life, where you just kind of have to... probably about a decade ago, I just had to make a conscious choice. If I'm going to read any kind of feedback on my on the way I am perceived in public, I'm going to read some really nice stuff. But the flip side of that is I'm always going to read some hateful stuff. So there are days, it's kind of on a case by case basis. There are times when I feel really solid and I always know I'm going to hear something negative along with a positive, and I can kind of breeze through some comments. And then there are times when I think, you know what? I'm having a really nice day. I really like what I said. I'm not even going to look. Yeah. And because there's a price to be paid for both. And, yes. You know, it's interesting. I did a commentary for CBS so many years ago about not being a pet person. And in my intro that you read, I always joke that I live in New York with my husband, my kids, and my husband's dog, because his dog is not my dog, but his dog lives in our home. And I was really clear that, like, I love animals, but I live in an apartment in New York City, and I'm just not a pet person. I think it's great if you want a dog. I get so much hate email. It was astonishing. And then very soon after that, I had an appearance on Fox News. I was on Bill O'Reilly's show.
Oh, I've been on this twice.
yeah. This was a long time ago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I was making jokes. I mean, they booked me to be like funny liberal. And then I get another round of incredibly misogynistic, scary, hateful email. And when all this stuff came out about O'Reilly, when was it? May, April? I can't remember. I think it was April. This past April, when he left Fox News, it was a really kind of come full circle moment, because I ended up writing a piece for Jezebel about the title, I think, was Bill O'Reilly Didn't Harass Me, But His Viewers Did. And I could kind of go back and repurpose. I had saved the stuff that people sent me was so crazy that I had saved it and never wanted to look at it again. I looked at it to write this book because I mentioned it in Approval Junkie. But I went back and I got to kind of like, I get to use it for greater good. And I wrote this article about how being on his show opened me up to the type of hate engendered by his show. Like the people who watch his show have disrespect women, and here's what they said about me. And that was the one time where I felt totally fearless to go to the Jezebel website. And I read there were like 250 comments, and virtually all of them were so supportive. And you know, I felt very cosseted to know that, you know, all of us, we have our people out there.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
That's so funny you said that, because I just heard a speech about that. But I have to talk about CBS Morning, because, first of all, I am obsessed with that show. My husband and I watch it, and then it didn't dawn on me until, like, just recently, that you are the I was, like, flipping out, and now I'm, like, such a profound, even more respect for you, because I know exactly the two-minute commentaries you do. You're hilarious, and you bring so much light and love to that show.
Oh,
so,
I have to watch it now.
Yes, you have to watch it. And you know, I think it's easier for people behind a computer to hide and say mean remarks. I mean, you know, it's like
there's so much envy in the world too. That's what I've learned when I used to get all that negative.
Is that Deborah?
Yeah. Yes.
Is that Deborah talking about envy?
Yeah, that's what I
did. You just say envy?
Envy.
So this is what I want to write about next.
Oh.
It's so, I mean, it is envy is as ubiquitous as approval seeking for sure. And I just think, you know, there's this quotation. When I knew I wanted to write about envy, it was when I read this quotation. Maybe you've heard it. It's attributed to Theodore Roosevelt. I don't know if he really said it. It is, comparison is the thief of joy.
Wow.
And the minute you go on Facebook or Instagram and you see everybody's shiny, filtered, happy life, no matter how happy you were that day, you're starting to, you're stealing the joy from your own world, from all the things you have to be grateful for. You're like, oh, but wait, you know, my home doesn't look like that, or my lemon meringue pie was weeping, or whatever. And you're right. Envy is as human. How can you not want what other people have? Like, it's as human as seeking approval, but it's so deleterious to our happiness.
Yes.
Yeah, I always just divide it into two different types. There's destructive envy and constructive envy, because you can admire something in someone else, and it might actually inspire you to do what you need to do to be able to either acquire that or develop that within yourself, versus the destructive envy, which is what you're talking about. And they really are significantly different. I think a lot of people also confuse envy with jealousy.
Jealousy,
really two extremely different experiences.
Things.
They can go hand in hand, but envy is the coveting of as what somebody else has, and in the destructive form, it's then wanting to destroy it in somebody else instead of facing your own sense of inadequacy.
But what's the difference between jealousy?
Jealousy is a three-pronged process. That's where you are fearful of the loss of something by some other intruder, right? So if you and your husband are having dinner and an attractive woman walks in and he looks at her, then that could inspire jealousy. It could also inspire envy if you think she's damn hot. I want to look like that.
Kelly...
Yeah.
Like Kelly, the way if you are a Shakespeare fan, you can think of Othello, right? Othello is jealous of Desdemona, but I think Iago is envious of Othello, right?
So interesting.
Yeah, and we can be jealous about anything.
Sure.
Right? Mm-hmm. We can be envious about anything, but it's one is three, one is two. That's the way I learned
and
it.
And I advise some of my clients to get off social media more because I think it's so, I mean, they've done studies to show that people who are on social media, on Facebook, looking at other people's profiles and pictures, they tend to get more depressed. And I think because you're seeing snapshots of people's lives that look so great and appealing, and you start to think, oh my God, but my life doesn't look like that all the time. And you get depressed.
Body image.
But you mentioned how empowered people feel by the anonymity of, you know, people can write me hateful things. They're never going to meet me. They don't know me at all. They just say something on Facebook page. And what I have found on the rare occasions I do this is when I respond to them personally.
Yeah.
And, you know, I try to channel Michelle Obama and go hi. And it's so funny because the minute you remind them that there's a human there, there's like, they either follow me on Twitter or they're like, you know, they give me a like or whatever.
Oh my God, that's like, so funny.
People are just, no matter what, no matter how hateful they are, I feel like they're still just yearning to connect and be noticed.
That's so true.
And sometimes I think people just want airtime. They like to be controversial or mean because it gets them attention.
Yes.
Right?
I mean, absolutely.
Yeah.
But I know, I never understood people why they have to say something mean. You could say something constructive. Like, you know, I really don't think that you were really on your game doing that show. You know, like, you didn't strike me as being ultra confident in what you're speaking. That would be constructive versus you're an idiot or.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Oh, right. Or they can just disagree with the content of what I'm saying. Like, hey, go for that. But if they're like, I turn the TV off as soon as I see her, you know, her voice is like nails on a chalkboard. It's like, God.
Like, I can't understand how people could live with themselves with saying such hurtful and horrible things. It's like, how do they not have that empathy? But I think you're right. I think it's like, you know, there you are on the TV and you're not really real. You're just sort of this, you know, thing. And then there is this feeling, I think, with the audience that they have the right to just say whatever they want because, you know, you're in the spotlight. You've paved this life for yourself or whatever. They feel entitled, I think, to kind of say whatever they want, which is horrible.
Although I have to confess, as much as I sound like I take the high road, I mean, I have not said the nicest things about our president on social media.
No. Who has?
But I haven't called him a name. So.
Right. It's so funny because I had a dream last night, hand to God, that I met Kathy Griffin and I was talking to her about like what happened with her and Trump. Isn't that so funny? And I got to analyze that later. But so if you
I've got time on the couch for you after the show.
Yeah, exactly. If you just tuned in, we are talking with Faith Sally, the wonderful, and her book, Approval Junkie.
So, Faith, you have a chapter devoted to the art of listening. What does listening have to do with approval?
I'm sure you guys know this well because people pay you just to listen to them like no one else in their lives will. When I made the shift from acting to being whatever I am now, a journalist and a commentator and a writer, whatever, I was hired to host a national public radio show. And I didn't have a background in that at all. But I was a pretty, pretty good interviewer. What I became from doing interviews every day on an hour-long show was a really, I'd like to think, a really good listener. And I have to say, I was in London last week for CBS Sunday Morning doing some stories, and I met up with a dear old friend from grad school because I went to grad school in England. And as we were walking through Regent's Park, she just turned to me and she grabbed my wrist and she said, "Do you know you're the best listener I ever met?" And it was
wow, how sweet.
One of the best compliments I've ever had in my life. It meant so much to me. And to answer your question, what it has to do with approval is the way to win. I mean, I don't listen disingenuously. Everyone has a story or a thousand, and I love asking people to tell me their stories. But the best way to get people to like you is to listen to them, like truly listen. Mm-hmm. Because what you're really helping them do is fall in love with themselves a little bit more.
Wow. So
and I think that our the pace of our lives is so frenzied, and people are so eager and breathless to be heard that we so rarely stop to listen mm-hmm. without an agenda. And I think that's what, you know, listen, going out to dinner with your girlfriends is one thing. And you probably have a lot of topics that, you know, we all have a lot of topics we can sort of glom on, and we all have similar stories or want to top each other's stories. But when you're interviewing someone, the discipline that comes with interviewing someone that can carry over into your real life is that you're really shining the spotlight light on that person. You're not there to swap stories. You're there to understand something new and maybe even allow the person you're interviewing to discover something new about mm-hmm. himself or herself. And that means you're not interrupting them. It means you're not waiting for them to finish what they're saying so you can say, yeah, but when I, whatever the case may be. And it also means, you know, I also found this when I started interviewing, and I'm sure you guys do this too because you're professionals, you're prepared. You have a list of questions you want to ask if you can when you're an interviewer.
Sure.
But if you're true, you know, because you've done some research, but if you've prepared, but if you're truly listening, the best way to demonstrate that is by letting the conversation move organically to the next question. So if someone reveals something that, you know, is elliptical or begs for you to ask more of a question, you continue with that discussion rather than sort of looking down at your numbered questions and moving on to a, you know, mm-hmm. to a sort of non sequitur question. And I just think when someone feels really heard, it's so validating.
So true. Oh my gosh. We do that in couples therapy with
yes.
active listening.
You yes.
need a partner to just sit there and literally empathize, reflect back, mm-hmm. none of their own agenda, none of their own thoughts yes. about it, but because it can help transform an experience too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you could have a fight about something because you're not really listening. When you really understand the depth of what somebody's experiencing, it's oftentimes not at all what you thought.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, it's so true.
Yeah, it's really hard to do, and I try to, and I'm not great at it all the time. Like if I'm having some kind of a tense discussion with my husband, when I can shift myself and think, okay, pretend this is an interview and all you want to do is allow him to speak so you can understand him better, mm. it completely shifts the way the discussion goes.
Right. That's a great technique. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I love what you said. I wrote it down. Listening enables people to fall in love with themselves more because, you know, it's funny. I've been a therapist for a while, but I've never thought about it in those terms. Mm-hmm. I always thought it was just like, oh, they needed that space but it's so true because then, you know, they kind of discover parts of themselves that they didn't before. I think in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of the best experiences I can ever have after an interview is mm-hmm. when someone says, wow, I've never said that before. Or wow, I didn't realize I've never told, you know, I just surprised myself. That's such a rewarding experience. And you know, sometimes the best conversations or listening experiences come from really simple questions. Mm-hmm. When I started interviewing, I realized how rarely, it both in professional interviews and in real life, we just ask somebody why. And it doesn't need to be in a challenging way, but we all sort of wrap our identities around the things we believe. And I think this, and I'm a liberal or I'm a conservative, and you know, this is the way it is. And it's just so rare that someone who genuinely wants to know says to you, why? Mm-hmm. And then you can really exchange ideas and unpack, you know, your worldview and maybe discover something new.
Absolutely. Yeah. Do you find too, that when you do that kind of active listening and you're kind of mirroring back to the person to some degree what they're saying, it helps the person actually also unravel whether that's really their truth or not. Sometimes when we hear something
yeah.
back in a reflective way from someone without judgment and without, you know, any kind of, you know, disdain about it, but just like curiosity. It's so interesting how our own selves evolve in those kinds of conversations.
I remember hearing a story back in the 90s when Bill Clinton, he was either running for president or was president, and he was on some college campus, and I think some kid raised his hand, and instead of asking a really, you know, pertinent political question, he was like, do you have any advice about how to get the ladies? And everybody laughed, and Bill Clinton didn't miss a beat, and you know, purportedly he said, yeah, listen, don't talk so much, just listen. And it's true. I mean, I can't tell you, before I met my husband, I just went, my current husband. Uh-huh. Well, oh, that sounds terrible. That sounds like I'm going to have another husband. I mean,
we understood.
I mean, my second husband. Uh-huh. I dated anybody. I told friends, like, if you think I should meet somebody, I will go out on dates. And I would go out on these dates, and many of them, I didn't feel like there was any chemistry. I never felt like it was a waste of time, though, because I love to meet new people. But after so many of these dates, these men would walk away thinking it was like we just had a fantastic evening. And not because, like, I'm so beguiling. It's just because I listened. Yeah. Like, they talked the whole time, and I listened. And they left there feeling like, I am a stud.
Uh-huh. It's so true. I was amazed when I was single, too, how many people... It was like a one-way conversation, and it's like nobody mm-hmm. sort of taught them. This is like a two-way conversation here, and yeah, to listen more. Wow.
And now I'm going to stereotype a little bit. I find that men, more often when I sort of eavesdrop on their conversations, they tend to trump each other with competitive stories more. Not that they're really trying to be competitive, but it's like, oh yeah, and I did that, and like, you know, it elevates and escalates in a way. What do you think about that?
Yeah.
More than women?
Women tend to be, we're just more thoughtful, I think, about not wanting mm-hmm. to hurt someone's feelings and making somebody feel sure. good. At least that's who I am. So yeah. I noticed that.
Do you
that.
Think it's an ego thing, or is it a way of men bonding?
I think so. It's like a stylistic thing. But yeah. I always find those conversations to be so unfulfilling.
Uh-huh. But I think it's more of a bonding.
I feel like if women ever try to top each other, it's only in a... like funny, self-deprecating way.
Right.
So if I told you a story about something ridiculous I did, you would try to like implicitly make me feel better by sharing
yes.
something that you did that is like way more ridiculous.
100%. I totally agree with you. But I think it's the same way. I think it's a bonding between men. It's like, oh yeah, 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 man, I've done that too. Like, I don't know if it's necessarily like, well, I'm better than you. Like, I wonder if it's just a male bonding. I don't know. It's a really interesting thought. I haven't thought about that.
Just an observation.
Yeah. But speaking of men and women, I want to know what you guys think about if women seek approval more than men. To me, it's so obvious.
You know, I'm always concerned about making generalizations. That's what I call generalizations based on sex. I think probably what I do know, or you can confirm if you agree with me, is that there are a million more ways for women to get validation than men. And I'm talking like, do you work? Do you not work? Do you change your name? Do you get bangs? Do you wear heels or flats? Like, mm-hmm. there's just a whole swath of choices we are presented with as women in our culture that men don't ever have to think about. And so any way you can choose to be is a way in our society to also lose approval from people, right? So did you work? Did you choose to have children when you were young or old? Did you breastfeed? Did you breastfeed long enough? Did you, you know, did you have your baby vaginally? Did you sign up for a C-section? You know, there's just a million ways that people, that women can have judgment passed on them, a million more ways than men. But I certainly wouldn't say that men don't care about approval. They may pretend that they don't. They may have a lot of bravado and swagger about not caring, but everybody cares. Everybody cares. Sure. And I also think it's generally men in our society. You know, I mentioned Kanye West in the beginning of my book. Like, I sort of put him at one end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. This is back before Trump was ubiquitous on the scene, because I probably would have used him as an example of someone who says he doesn't care what people think. But Kanye West always says, you know, I don't give a shit what people think because people don't think. And obviously those people who proclaim it the most, who are often men, care the most about what people think.
Yes. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, but I'm going to make a sweeping generalization here. I do feel in general, I think women really do care. I mean, not every woman, but I do. I really feel that way. And I think it's exactly the reasons that you stated. I think there are more choices. I think that women are typically more people pleasers than men. Do you agree, Deborah?
There's just so many more things, as Faith was saying, and you're saying, that we judge women about, that we're critical of women about. Whereas I think, by and large, at least in this society, we kind of look at men as like, is he successful or not successful? We don't care what, if he wore a certain kind of shoes to get successful. But mm-hmm. we were like you said, when you were, you know, the people talking about your voice. I mean, really? What is that? But that's irrelevant
right.
to what you're saying.
Yes.
And yet somebody decided to criticize you about that. By the way, you have a lovely voice.
So yeah.
I don't know what idiot decided to say that.
Yes.
It's like, and you're so articulate. And I love the way you speak, because I get pictures, and I love to see pictures. And when you speak, I get pictures, which is awesome.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you.
Yeah. So I think, yeah, we're just so petty and picky about mm-hmm. women, you know?
Sure.
You know, the last chapter in my book, though, and you are both, Deborah, you have raised a daughter, and Kelly, you're raising a daughter, and so am I. My daughter just turned 3. I sold this book while I was pregnant with her and wrote it while I was, you know, losing my mucus plug and breastfeeding 16 times a day. So, she has grown up with this book, and the penultimate chapter in the book is a letter to her, and it is sort of a pithy list of what I've learned about seeking approval, because especially for girls and women in our culture, you know, you really do want to thread the needle, because as I said, I don't think that not giving a F, as the kids say, is the secret to success and fulfillment. But you know, young women and older women too should be wary of why they're seeking approval and from whom, right? It's not like, you know, I don't care about the approval of the moms at school drop-off, but do I care about the approval of my kids in terms of, are they happy and joyful?
Yes.
And have they learned to be grateful young people? Yeah, I do care about that, you know? So it's a constant, I mean, I think as women, we have to be constantly on guard for why we want to be noticed and loved, and by whom and for whom.
I love one of these that you do write to her about, Coco Chanel. Before you leave the house, look in the mirror and remove one accessory. Your mother says, before you leave the apartment, look in the mirror and remove your breathe right nasal strip.
Yes, I have been about to leave my home with my massive breathe right nasal strip across my nose.
Those work. They are really good, by the way, because David snores.
But don't you think that they work so aggressively? I'm always afraid after I wear them that my nose has grown 3 times its size and it's going to stay that way.
I never thought about it, but you might be right. It's got to be doing something.
I feel like my nostrils get bigger for 3 days.
That is so funny.
So funny. I always have a fear that I'm going to accidentally leave my house not putting a shirt on, because sometimes when I'm getting dressed in the morning, it's so hot sometimes that, you know, you have the bra on and just running around doing everything. Yeah. And then, you know, it's like running late, just running out of the house going, holy crap,
you're like, oh,
I forgot to put a shirt on.
Yeah, absolutely. Could be.
Okay, now look, I would love to live in a house, but I live in an apartment building in New York City, and you've just given me a new appreciation for doormen. I do think that Carlos the doorman would remind me to put a shirt on before
exactly.
I leave the building.
That's part of his job.
He might take an extra moment or two to remind you, right?
Yeah, you know, we live on the 22nd floor, and there's a public, like a building terrace on our floor.
Uh-huh.
And then the building goes up higher than that. And when I had both my kids, I would like in the terrace abuts our apartment. So there's a whole wall of windows where people on the terrace can see inside our apartment. And when you have little babies, your body, it just belongs to everybody,
yes.
right? And I would walk around the apartment breastfeeding my kids. And, like, why bother to put a shirt on when you're breastfeeding?
Right.
I mean,
why?
It's
right.
like,
exactly.
You don't know when you're going to have to pick up your kid and feed it.
Yes.
I would walk around topless. I mean, not on purpose.
Right.
I certainly didn't think I was looking great, but I would always forget, and I'd be walking by the window breastfeeding my kid, and there was this French family that was always picnicking outside, and they would give me this raucous thumbs up.
That, oh my gosh. In France, it's like,
I
right
think,
on.
But But they were French, so I really think they were making fun of me.
Oh, that's so,
that is so
well, the same thing happened with me. So we have a construction site. My old neighbors left. They're knocking down the house. So it was a little bit lower than my house. So I was always fine walking around naked. Suddenly now there's all these construction workers.
Oh, no.
And in my bathroom after I got out of the shower, I was so used to just, you know, letting it all hang loose. Well, I look up in the mirror and there's like a couple construction workers
just
having a party.
Down.
Oh, my gosh.
Enjoying themselves. On their break.
Yes, right? And I'm like, oh.
Oh, my God.
That's really funny. But I'm all about it. I feel like, you know what? It's all good. That's
Look,
really funny.
You made their day. It didn't cost you anything. It didn't hurt you, right?
Exactly. They needed a little break, you know.
The other one is dry shampoo makes your life 33% easier.
Yes.
I love that.
I love dry shampoo.
Oh, my God.
It.
I mean, you guys, when I get a blowout, people should wear a hazmat suit around my hair. I'm like, I'm going to make this work for like 6 days before I wash it again.
100%. I'm so with you. Well, people, I have naturally curly hair. So when I straighten my hair, I mean, it's work. Like, it is serious work. And so when I straighten it, like, don't even get near, like, humidity, water, anything. So, yeah, I'm all about the dry shampoo, too. Love it. Well,
you know, Deborah, I appreciate your reading a few of those. I have to tell you, I was rereading my own book recently. It's funny because, you know, I started writing this, my gosh, like 4 years ago. And then sometimes I come back to my own book and I'm like, oh, I wrote that?
Yeah.
I love, there's this one line that, yeah, as my daughter gets older, you know, she's still only three, but, you know, I'm sure you guys think about this too. Like when you meet a young, lovely girl, you always think, oh, should I tell her she's pretty? Or do I have to tell her she's smart and strong before I tell her she's pretty?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote this one line that I want to tell her every day as she grows up. Focus on being beautiful if you want to get something from people. Focus on being smart and or funny if you want to give something to people.
Mm-hmm.
And as I get older and less attractive, because that's just the way the world works,
mm-hmm.
I do find that, you know, okay, what will I always have to offer? I will always have to offer my thoughts and my humor, you know?
So I love that. I absolutely love that.
Yeah.
So we only have a couple minutes left. Faith, do you want to say anything else that you feel like we haven't talked about? Or what
oh my
are you doing
gosh,
next?
I want to say to you guys, come to New York so we can all go out and have a drink.
Oh my
God. You guys are so much fun to talk to. You know, I do want to say that there, you know, writing the book, even logistically, wasn't terribly easy because I had a toddler and I had a newborn and I had a few other jobs and I didn't even have a desk in our apartment.
Wow.
And there are sacrifices that come with that. And I recently, you know, I also spent some time, like meaningful time away from my kids to write this book. And recently someone told me a quote. It's from Carl Jung. And it says, the greatest harm you can do to a child is the unlived life of its parent.
Ah.
And when I read that, it made me feel so whole about the hours that I spent away from my children writing this book, but knowing that it was something I always wanted to accomplish. These stories are stories that I wanted to tell and share with people. I hope they will move people or make them laugh. But also at the end of the day, my mother died when I was 26. She can't answer any of my questions. I don't have her story, so I feel like I don't have all of my story. But my kids, whether they want to know these things or not, you know, they have a story of their mother, and I feel like I gave them, at the very least, I gave them the story of their mother and how much they were wanted in this book.
I love that.
That's so
sweet. That's so beautiful. That is really,
thank
really
you.
Sweet. Yes.
And are you doing a one woman show? I heard, or what's next for you?
I am. There's a theater. I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, and growing up, I always went to this amazing repertory theater called the Alliance Theater. And the executive director of the Alliance Theater sent me an email out of the blue. I didn't know her about a year ago. Then the subject line was "crazy idea," and they asked me if I would turn my book into a one woman show for their 50th anniversary season.
That's awesome.
And
congratulations.
I don't know how I'm going to do it. Like, we'll figure out the childcare. I'll be in Atlanta for 2 months. We'll make it work. But I couldn't, I couldn't say no. It's such an honor to think that people might want to sit in a theater and hear me tell these stories.
That is so cool. Okay, so we are running out of time, like really quickly here. Faith Sally, the author of Approval Junkie, where can people find the book and find you?
It's at any bookstore. Of course, it's on Amazon. And you can go to faithsalie.com. That's Sally is S-A-L-I-E. And you can see me on Sunday morning or listen to me on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on NPR. And I can't thank you both enough. This is so nice.
We adore you.
Adore you. Oh
we
my gosh,
love you. Thank you so much.
Oh, my God. Approval. Approval. I love it.
Yes. So much fun.
Thank you so much. That was
Faith.
Take care.
All right.
Thanks.
Bye, hon.
Bye.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.